We will hear the word of the Lord from Ruth chapter 2. If you are using your pew Bible, it is starting on page 222. Hear the word of the Lord from Ruth 2. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him, in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was part of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by God, the Lord of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her and leave it for her to glean and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she gleaned, and she also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I worked today was Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close to my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law. The word of the Lord.
I am delighted to be with you all today, and to be in this beautiful space. And I'm sure everyone who steps into this pulpit references the great cloud of witnesses around us. But I will do my best not to be distracted by this. My studies are in art and theology, and I think this is entirely unfair. But I also see the cloud of witnesses in front of me. And I know some of you, I've worked with Dr. Lang, 6-7 years now on projects. Is Dr. Ginellette here? He may not be, so that's all the better. Dr. Lang said I could do this. He wouldn't remember me, but we were actually in undergrad together. and I knew him. He was a couple years ahead of me. I worked in the library, so I saw a lot of the Bible theology types coming in. But my memory of Dr. Gentilette is that one year he won the preaching contest for the undergrad. And I remember that sermon to this day. And you will have to go ask him his text, because that's why I remember it. It was pretty overwhelming. I think it was Ezekiel 16. So you go ask him about that. He did a phenomenal job. It was a wonderful sermon. But I do remember it to this day, and that all can encourage you that your sermons can stick and lodge and haunt people for 25 years, if done correctly. I am grateful, though, to have a few moments with you, and we are going to, if you can ignore all of this, we are going to be in the book of Ruth for our time together this morning. And I realize that we kind of jumped into the middle of the story. I was asked what the reading should be, and I said, well, the entire book. I mean, how are we going to work through all that's there? But I narrowed it down to Ruth 2, and there's a reason for that, and we'll get to that eventually. But I do want to make this point that by having a reading in Ruth 2, we are really entering the story in medias res, or in the middle of things. There's things that have already happened, there's things yet to come, but we're jumping right in after the action has already started. And that's both serendipitous and intentional, because the story of Ruth itself is something of an in medias res story. There's things that have happened before it, there's things that have happened after it. Ruth comes onto the scene, she enters the stage, so to speak, mid-act. She is a link in the story of the nation of Israel, and she is a link in the story of salvation history. And we know that in particular because the book opens that way. It tells us immediately that we are entering the action in the middle of things. The first verse says, in the days when the judges ruled. So we're already situated within a particular time. And within the Christian canon, the book of Ruth acts as something of a bridge between the end of Judges to 1 Samuel. And so it's picking up the story, at least thematically and contextually, where Judges leaves off. The narrator of Scripture has passed the baton from the events of Judges to Ruth, who will then hand it off to 1 Samuel, where we begin to get the backstory of King David, who will eventually be given the covenant, the Davidic covenant. So when we enter in medias res in the days of Judges, we also have to kind of think what was happening before. Now, Dr. Lang, I will call her Stefana, I am sorry, but Dr. Lang and I have been working on a study Bible project now for 6 or 7 years, and when you spend that much time in a text and that extensive kind of exploration, working at a large scale, you begin to see patterns. And one of the patterns we recognize, and it's clearly within Judges, that you can trace the collapse of the nation of Israel around the stories of the treatment of the vulnerable and poor, especially women, widows, orphans, foreigners. The further the nation goes from God, the worse and worse it gets for the marginalized. The stories and accounts become more grotesque and violent, which signals to affirm the Bible's teaching that when people are close to God and they are following his ways, there is shalom and prosperity for all. And when you move away from the covenant, violence comes into a society. And this is precisely the pattern that you see in Judges. The book opens with a story of Caleb and his daughter Aksa and her husband Othniel. Now, it's set in another time and another place, and if you just have a superficial reading, it could sound potentially like Caleb is giving his daughter away as a prize. I get that. But it's actually this very collaborative, safe space for Aksa. She has a father who listens to her, who grants her requests. She has a husband who is courageous and proves himself as a man of faith and valor. So it begins with this beautiful setting in which a woman is kept safe by the men around her. But as the book progresses, we move to Deborah in jail, who have to start taking up responsibility and protect in many ways themselves. Slowly, we get to the story of Jephthah's daughter, and then Samson's many wives who are used as pawns in his own personal drama. And by the time you get to the last couple chapters of the book, you've got Micah, the Levite's concubine that is violently assaulted, killed, and desecrated, as if the most important thing to the Levite was to prove the point how he had been harmed. And the book ends, Judges ends, with the nation beginning to turn in on itself. Women and young girls are abducted in the very act of worship and forced into marriages. And the worst thing for me is that their fathers do nothing. In the days when the judges ruled, that's where we enter the story. That's where Ruth enters the story. And in this way, with this pattern in place, you can see that women act as a kind of everyman to reveal what the state of a society was. They are a canary in the coal mine. How a nation, church, or society is treating women suggests something about the spiritual state of that institution and its communal integrity. And so we come to Ruth. We begin our story in medias res, in the middle of things. Now, the good news, and I'll give you the look forward, by the time we exit the story, things are better. The last verses will propel us into 1 Samuel, the backstory of King David. But that kind of juxtaposition also suggests something about the book of Ruth. It suggests that whatever is happening in this little four-chapter book is a kind of turning point, a hinge, a fulcrum. It suggests something about how we might move from times and places of deep instability and chaos to greater stability. More to the point, it suggests something about what happens between generations when the baton of history is passed to the next generation and they take it up in order to pass it on. Now, I know this is a seminary. And there are some of you with an eye for detail that might say, well, yes, that works if you stick with the Christian canon. But in the Hebrew scriptures, yes, in the Hebrew scriptures, Ruth is in the writings among the wisdom literature. I don't think this is a problem, though, and it doesn't necessarily conflict with my premise that Ruth is acting as a fulcrum or a bridge book. Because what that suggests to me is that whatever is happening in this little book is a particular form of wisdom. It's a particular form of wisdom that is necessary in times of chaos. It's the particular form of wisdom that is needed to make generational change. The wisdom that is needed to receive a particular inheritance and find ourselves in the midst of it and somehow pass on a different inheritance. It's the wisdom of generational engagement, how to heal generational wounds so that they are not passed on insofar as possible. In particular, and you know this all because you're scholars, the book of Ruth focuses on the wisdom, the deeply practical and prosaic wisdom of loving kindness. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's get back to Ruth. Ruth 1, in the days of the judges ruled. There was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. Again, we're picking up the story in medias res, and so we should expect when you enter a story that way that there are going to be callbacks or allusions to earlier scenes. I've already given you the context of Judges, what has brought us to this point. But this verse also has callbacks to another more particular story, and it holds in itself a deep irony about what had come before in regard to things like famine and food, bread and Moabites. And the original hearers of this book would have known that. First, there's the obvious irony that probably we can even pick up on. If you know that Bethlehem means house of bread, you hear this language that there's a famine in the land of the house of bread. The house of bread doesn't have any bread. Get it? So that motif is present from the beginning. But there's also an irony in Elimelech and his family seeking bread from Moab. In the history and imagination of Israel, Moab had a very particular association with food, and it was not a good one. You don't go to Moab seeking food. In fact, you don't have anything to do with Moab, because in the history between Israel and Moab, the Moabites have proven themselves faithless. They had not given the Israelites food and water in their journey in the wilderness, and God named this as something against them. Deuteronomy 23, in fact, it records it this way: Moabites shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever, because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt, because they hired against you Balaam, the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse you. So there's a history here. We're entering into the middle of the story. So by the time we actually come to our text itself, Ruth 2, a lot has been happening and a lot is going on underneath. And I think that's part of the reason why, repeatedly, the narrator wants to make sure you know that Ruth is a Moabite. You know Ruth from Moab, the Moabite. There's language of foreigner as a general term for her, but it is consistent and repeatedly mentioned that she is from Moab. So to get to chapter 3, we have to catch up a little bit. Elimelech and Naomi go to Moab. They get food there. They have tragedy there. Naomi, now with Ruth, are returning to Bethlehem. The famine is over, but they return poor, disenfranchised, destitute, and hungry. So here's the irony again. Naomi had left Bethlehem because there was insufficient food, and now, having returned, even though the famine is abated, she again finds herself with insufficient food. And that's why we read chapter 2 this morning, because the motif or the theme of food is most densely present in this chapter. So Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, who loves her, offers to glean in the fields, to collect whatever scraps she can to feed herself and her mother-in-law. And you know the story. She comes upon the field of a man named Boaz, and she catches his attention. And Boaz says in verse 5, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reaper said, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab." Remember, we're entering the story in medias res, and things have happened before, and they are very significant to this encounter. Generational and historical realities are coming to a head in this moment, and people like Boaz and Ruth and Naomi are finally stepping onto the stage in the middle of a play. But there's a question in this book, and a question in our own lives, is what script will they follow? And here's where we begin to understand that the story of Israel and the story of our own lives is less a script and more an improv sketch. It's based on a script, and there are agreed upon points, but we step onto the stage and we step on with agency and action. So Ruth and Boaz both make moves in this chapter that become hinges or fulcrums that will affect what will come after this book closes. Now, I want to give full credit to this next observation. This comes from Rabbi Shai Held, who I first heard this observation from. And Rabbi Held made the point that Boaz chooses to do something that reverses a generational norm. In verse 14, Boaz says to Ruth, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain, and she ate it until she was satisfied and she had some left over. Boaz chooses to feed his enemy. He chooses to feed the Moabite who did not feed his own ancestors. And that could be seen as a beautiful act of loving our enemies and doing good to those who hurt us, and it absolutely is. But I also want to pick up on the thread later in the book where Naomi says to Ruth, Boaz is one of our redeemers. Now, we traditionally think that that's casting forward to the marriage, that Boaz will be the kinsman redeemer for Ruth, and it is. But there's also a hint here that he's already beginning to redeem, because this is the shape of redemption. It recapitulates. Now, you're all very smart people, and you've probably read Irenaeus and Against Heresies, and so you know there that Irenaeus frames salvation as a form of reversal, of a knot being untangled, that whatever caught the knot has to be moved in the opposite direction in order to untangle it. And in particular, Irenaeus focuses on the knot of Eve's disobedience. Eve's disobedience was loosed by the obedience of Mary. From what the Virgin Eve had bound fast through unbelief, this did the Virgin Mary set free through faith. And that's a very particular form of recapitulation, but I would suggest that all of redemption is untying the knot, that you move in the opposite direction, you fulfill the law of God, Christ fulfills the law of God in order to redeem us. And so here we see Boaz operating in the opposite direction of what is anticipated, which then in turn frees and enables Ruth to close the circle. Here's how it works. Ruth, the Moabite, begs food, just as the Israelites had begged of Moab. Boaz, the Israelite, offers food and water and wine, redeeming the failure of the Moabites to feed Israel. Ruth, now full with excess, returns to her mother-in-law, Naomi, the Israelite, and finally is able to fulfill what Moab should have done all along. In this way, Boaz is a redeemer who fulfills the righteousness of the law on someone else's behalf, enabling them to fulfill God's commands. So what does Boaz do when it's his turn to step on the stage? Boaz chooses to step into the covenant of God's loving kindness and live out loving kindness. And Ruth, in turn, makes the choice to pick up that covenant and enter into the covenant with God as well. Because when Ruth questions, why are you treating me this way? Yes, Boaz has chosen to step into loving kindness. But Boaz also says to her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. Of course, if we've read chapter 1 and didn't just land in the middle of the story, we would have already read verses 16 and 17, where Ruth declares, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. You shall be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also if anything but death parts me from you." So Ruth, when she came on stage, chose to step into God's covenant of loving kindness and live out loving kindness. And then in chapter 2, she is able to take the grain that has been given to her and place it in her mother-in-law's lap, closing that circle. So that's how we get from Judges to 1 Samuel. But what about the wisdom? What is the wisdom of this particular bridge book? Again, I want to reiterate that it's important to understand Ruth not simply as a signifier of women, but as representative of the average person. In fact, the book is about what average people do in their lives. What do average people do when society is falling in chaos around you? I think the first thing that I reflect on is that we must understand our own lives as happening in medias res. Now, we've been told a cultural story that we somehow just appeared on the scene and that we make of ourselves and our lives whatever we want. But the truth is, we all enter a story that is already happening. We too come on the scene mid-act, We inherit everything that has already happened before us, and we will most certainly pass on things to the generation that follows us. We are not self-made people. We did not just suddenly appear on the planet from nowhere. We are situated between generations, and we must learn how to relate to what has come before and what will come after. The second thing I reflect on is that each generation is given the responsibility and the opportunity to course correct, to receive a certain heading, but to change it. We are each asked to take up the covenant of loving kindness. When you look at the Old Testament, and this is again one of the patterns you see, it's very easy to read Israel as monolithic. That there's just this constant back and forth and back and forth. Do they follow God's law? Do they not follow God's law? And if you are not careful, you could just read that as one nation. And it is, but it's individual generations. It's a constant cycle of each generation stepping onto the scene and choosing whether they would honor the covenant that they had received. Ruth is voicing when she says, "Your God will be my God," what each generation must voice for themselves. Each generation must choose to do something with what they've inherited. Now, this is a comfort because what you have received is not determinative. Your family of origin, your trauma, your pain, your conflict does not set the course of your life. Loving kindness and the covenant of God can change that direction. But there's a caution here as well, because what you have received is not determinative. You cannot just expect that everything you have brought into, the goodness, the stability, will just continue on. At some point, the systems that you are part of, you must step up and you must own your own life. You must step up and enter into the covenant of loving kindness with God and neighbor. But when you do, you have the confidence that God works through small, faithful acts of loving kindness between individuals. He uses women. He uses the outsider. He uses the poor. He uses the everyman. And what is an irony as well, the book opens with a reference to the judges and the days the judges ruled, as if their authority and what they did at the highest places of power is what would dictate what would come. And then the book absolutely turns away from their power and says, you know, it's the loving kindness that we exercise between each other as individuals that changes the course of the generations. Because when we come to the end of the book, we see that we are propelled forward into the story of David. Boaz does marry Ruth. She is redeemed. Land is redeemed. Loving kindness abounds. And from that life-giving place, new life is generated and birthed. And Ruth places her son in Naomi's lap. And there is great rejoicing. And this son, whom they named Obed, he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And so the last thing I'll leave you with as a reflection is that God plays the long game. I've asked you to see the story of Ruth as in medias res. We looked at the background, we looked at what comes after, and that this book bridges us from one place to another. And sure enough, we get to the story of David. And you know, within that story, as complicated as it is the promise of the Davidic line, of the covenant. And God says to David in 2 Samuel, "I will provide a place for my people Israel and will plant them so that they can have a home of their own and no longer be disturbed. Wicked people will not oppress them anymore as they did in the beginning. And I have done ever since the time I appointed leaders over my people Israel. I will also give you rest from all your enemies. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will play the long game. He will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom." Those of us who know that this is fulfilled in our Savior, Jesus the Lord, know that he picked up the story that is told in the book of Ruth as well. He was a descendant, yes, but he also lived out loving kindness, for it was he who fed the crowds and had leftovers, just like Boaz fed Ruth and she had leftovers. And it was he who said, "I am the bread of life." And it was he who said, "Take, eat, this is my body broken for you." He would feed us with his own body. So what can the average person do in times of political and social upheaval? What is expected of you? How can you bridge from what is to what will come, from chaos to peace? What would it look like to enter the stage the way Ruth and Boaz did? Well, it would look like stepping into God's covenant of loving kindness, living out that loving kindness, trusting that God's own loving kindness will fulfill it. Amen.
Now please receive this benediction from 1 Corinthians. "And so, my beloved brothers and sisters, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord, your labor is not in vain. Go in peace."